Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for being with us this evening. My name is Joshua Estes, and I am a co-president of the Connecticut Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is a nonpartisan group of lawyers, law students, and public policy professionals devoted to the following three and only three principles. The state exists to preserve freedom, the separation of powers is essential to our Constitution, and it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is and not what it should be. A note for attendees here, if you would like to ask questions, there should be a way for you to click on a Q&A box on your screen that will populate to us, and at the appropriate point in time, the panel can take your questions. With that, I would like to introduce our esteemed panel. First, we have Senator Len Fasano. Senator Fasano is the Republican representing the 34th Senate District, which includes the communities of Durham, East Haven, North Haven, and Wallingford, a seat he has held since 2003. In the General Assembly, Senator Fasano has served as leader of the Senate Republican Caucus since 2014. He is a partner at Fasano, Ippolito, Lee, and Florentine, and he holds a bachelor's from Yale University, a JD from Bridgeport School of Law, and an LLM from the Boston University School of Law. Second, we have Proloy Das. Proloy is a partner at Mirtha Colina and a chair of the Appellate Practice Group. He has argued over 60 appeals before the Connecticut Supreme Court, the Connecticut Appellate Court, and the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He most recently argued Fay v. Merrill, which was a challenge to the absentee balloting laws and for this August primary brought by two Republican congressional candidates in congressional districts 1 and 2 in the state. He holds a JD from Indiana University and an AB in economics and political science from Boston College. Third, we have Fred DeCaro. Fred has been a registrar of voters for the Republicans in Greenwich for the last 12 years. This upcoming election will be the third election, presidential election, he's administering. Fred is a former member of the Board of Directors of the Registrar of Voters Association of Connecticut, as well as a former chair of its Fairfield County chapter. Fred has completed several years of study and earned a graduate level certificate in elections administration from the Humphrey School of Government at the University of Minnesota. And Fred has an undergraduate degree in American history from Harvard College. So thank you all for being here this evening. First, I'd like to start by asking Proloy to sort of set the stage for the current state of absentee ballot law in the state of Connecticut. Sort of where do we stand legally, and how did we get here?
Sure. Thanks, Josh, for putting this panel together. You often hear that Connecticut's laws on absentee voting are very restrictive. And the reason for that is it's found in our Constitution. Article 6, Section 7 of our Constitution only allows individuals to vote by absentee ballot if they're for particular reasons, because of sickness or physical disability, because of absence from their town or city, or because of their religious tenets. So that's found in our Constitution. We don't have no excuse voting here in Connecticut. Before I jump forward to 2020, let me talk about how we got here constitutionally, the history of you know, why those are the provisions, those are the excuses that are permitted. This all goes back to our first Constitution in 1818. And that constitutional required that all votes be conducted on one day in person. It became an issue during the Civil War when the legislature wanted to grant to Civil War soldiers the right to vote by absentee ballot. Can't possibly have a better reason or justification to vote by absentee ballot than that. The legislature passed a statute authorizing soldiers to vote by absentee ballot. It went up to the Connecticut Supreme Court, and the Connecticut Supreme Court said, as well-meaning as this is, you have to abide by your Constitution. And Josh, I was listening to kind of the fundamental principles of the Federal Society and the power essentially that the people, the elected officials get expressly from the Constitution, because that's what that decision was about. And what they said is The governing leaders can only derive their power from the electorate. The electorate expresses their will through the Constitution. Even if you want to do something as important as this, you have to get a constitutional amendment to do so. And in 1864, that's precisely what the electorate did. They amended the Constitution to allow soldiers in the Civil War to vote by absentee ballot. Flash forward to 1929. That's when the question about additional excuses to vote by absentee ballot came up. We had legislative hearings. And what we derived from that was that individuals who, for example, due to doctor's orders are not able to vote or are going to be out of town because they're students or they work outside the jurisdiction should be able to vote by absentee voting. And that went to the electorate in 1932, which put in those very limited provisions because of sickness or physical disability or because of absence from the town or city. Flash forward to 1964, religious tenets was added in large part because some municipalities were having municipal elections on the first Monday in October, which was conflicting with Jewish holidays. And that's where we are in 1964. That's the last constitutional amendment we've seen with respect to absentee voting. Flash forward to 2012, and legislation was proposed to try and get the question onto the ballot for the electorate to expand voting, absentee voting as a no excuse basis. Ultimately, that went to the electorate in 2014. It was a constitutional question. Should we amend the Constitution to allow for no excuse voting? The electorate rejected that, much to the surprise, I think, of the administration and the leadership, by 40,000 votes. Significantly, that's the first time in 60 years, going back to 1955, I should say the second time, that a constitutional amendment was rejected. Out of 45 constitutional amendments proposed, 43 passed by the electorate. So this was a really significant statement by the electorate that we did not want no excuse absentee voting in Connecticut. Flash forward to 2019, the secretary tried again to amend the Constitution, didn't get the votes in the legislature to put it onto the ballot. Flash forward to 2020, we have COVID-19. The secretary pressed the governor to use his executive order power to allow for absentee voting first in the primary. And the governor issued an order to that effect. And the way it was done was to characterize the order as being compliant with the Constitution in this way. Because the Constitution allows for people to vote if they're unable to do so because of sickness or disability, the governor said, well, COVID-19 is a sickness. And therefore, because of the sickness of COVID-19, its very existence, everyone in Connecticut can vote by absentee ballot. Flash forward to the special session in September that was implemented for the general election. We can talk about the litigation a little bit later, but that's kind of the backdrop. So why we have effectively no excuse absentee voting at this point.
So Senator Fasano, so Proloy has given us sort of the 200-year overview of absentee balloting here in the state of Connecticut. And he touched briefly at the end there on sort of where we are today. I think it'd be interesting to hear from you sort of what's been the back and forth between the legislative body and the executive as we think about safely and securely and fairly administering the primary and then this upcoming general election. And what has the relationship been with the executive branch and the Secretary of State just as we figure out the best way to do this and to do it in a way that comports with the state constitution and the Supreme Court's rulings on these issues they're under.
So Josh, thank you. And thank you for putting this together. Let me just say this. When Denise Merle's always, as Proloy has stated, has always had this affinity for opening up absentee ballots. That's been her mantra for a long time. So when this opportunity came about, she decided to take the advantage of it, if I may, and push forward on opening up absentee ballots. I think that she had a conversation with the governor, and the governor told her back in April to start talking to the leaders and make sure you had us weigh in. And I don't believe she really cared that much of the substance of our conversation. She did call me, I believe it was in April. I told her I was concerned over some issues, and I raised those issues. She assured me those weren't problems. And then the leaders talked. We did not really have many conversations with leaders and the executive branch. I recall one in which the Secretary of State was on, the Attorney General was on. I do recall one. But I think that Denise Burrell had made this opinion, as Proloy has suggested, that using the illness part of the Constitution could apply in the sense that Proloy suggested for absentee. So once she had the ability to mail them out, it was sort of, I have the right to mail it out. Then it became how we're going to handle it. And the governor did some executive orders to make that happen a little bit easier on her end. So I think that there was not a lot of back and forth. I think the Democrat majority leaders, I should say, in the House and the Senate, were not thrilled with this absentee. We all recognize there were issues. We recognize there were certain things that had to be in place, both logistically and legally. But the decision was made, the die was cast, it was off and running. We also believe if it came up in special session, it would be an extraordinarily long special session. So that's how we got through the primary. The governor then, as you recall, extended some time period to count the ballots, given the tropical storm that came through and the outages that we had. Then as we approached this election, the general election, the governor sort of intimated that if we did not go in a special session, he would stand down. If we did not go into special session, he would then reissue orders to allow absentee ballots to exist, just like in the primary. But if you're going into special session, you need to address it. So this was on the special session call, and it passed overwhelmingly. But it still doesn't mean there aren't problems that should be ironed out. But there really wasn't as much back and forth as some would think between the Secretary of State's office and the legislature, or the governor's office and the legislature. It was sort of, it was going ahead and get out of our way type of attitude, if I would.
So now that we're caught up to speed on where things stand today, you know, Fred, and your role as registrar, you're certainly involved heavily in the administration of elections, both this last primary and the upcoming general election. What was your experience with the primary election in light of the, you know, the highly increased number of absentee ballots as compared to usual? And you know, what sort of lessons should we learn? What are you expecting for this November as we think about administering the elections?
Sure. Well, first, let me give you a little bit of data. If I'm going to share my screen related to the primary. I think there's some interesting points to be made here. So the first is that we surveyed in my town those who came to the polls and asked them, well, how safe did you feel when you were there and casting your ballot in person? And what we found was that over 95% felt safe, very safe, or extremely safe as possible. So we do know that we're capable of running an election, even during a pandemic, where people feel safe. Now, we then asked people who were absentee ballot voters, if there were no pandemic, what's your preferred method of voting? And even among, and remember, these are just the absentee ballot voters, almost 70% of those folks said they'd prefer to return to vote in person. And I think that we're now seeing, we can talk more about some of the trends, that more and more people who were sort of into the concept of absentee ballots are now, even though we always say there's no voter fraud, are both sides are now saying, well, you know, maybe I should go to the polls. Now, again, when we asked those same people in the primary how confident they were their vote was cast, it's interesting to see that there's quite a few people, over 10%, that said they were not confident or not at all confident when they cast those absentee ballots. And that is really, I believe, a failure on the part of all of the executives, meaning the Secretary of State locally, as well as the president nationally, to sort of, you know, cast this sort of fear associated with the post office, where the reality is that when the post office has just delivered ballots on October 12th to folks, people got them the next day and were amazed at how well the post office has been doing. So now we're kind of seeing, you know, a lot of concern about the absentee process. I think the other thing that we realize is that if you look at the August election, it was taken as a test, and a lot of people were really sort of dipping their toe in the water to see, well, what is this really like? And in election studies, we kind of called this the novelty effect, right? So you have people who said, oh, you know, it's kind of like a free opportunity to try it. You sent me a free envelope. I'm going to give it a shot. And so you could see that the number of ballots that were actually mailed out was enormous. The total ballots in my town, 7,300. But then if you look at the number of ballots that were returned, it was only 4,500. And so people were kind of testing the process. But first of all, when they realized that it was only the primary, because I believe there was a lot of confusion that people thought they were in fact applying for a ballot for the presidential election, right? A lot of them did not get returned. And I think one of the concerns, as we said, is if you look here, 33% of the ballots in total didn't get returned. We're expecting that number to be much lower at the presidential election, but we really don't, because there is no ballot tracking mechanism. We don't work in the post office with that way. We really don't know how many ballots are not returned because people don't choose to return them, or because there is some sort of an issue with the transport of the ballots. I think one of the key points that we've been trying to do to educate voters is that even when ballots are returned on time, voters make errors. And there's no cure process associated with absentee voting in Connecticut. So we rejected 2% of the ballots that were cast in the primary. And they're rejected for three basic reasons. The first is that people fail to sign the affidavit, which is on the inner envelope. The second is that they don't actually put their ballot in that inner envelope. And the third is that they sometimes combine a husband and wife into one envelope, which is also a problem because we have no way of knowing, you know, when we're checking off who voted, who it is, and one of those ballots gets discarded. So I do think that the lessons really learned from this, and I'll stop sharing for now, are first, to quote Jefferson, I don't know if I have it exactly right, but the government serves the people best that is closest to the people. And when the Secretary of State administered this and sent ballots out across the state using a sort of one-stop mail warehouse, ballots went out 7 to 9 days late. And it's very interesting because neither the press nor I think the legislature in its oversight capacity has ever really identified how many days late those ballots were. Those ballots were supposed to be sent out 20 days in advance of a primary. We never got a straight answer as election administrators. They went out between 7 and 9 days late. Now, that has all been fixed for the presidential election because the Secretary of State realized that there was no way that they could maintain that same process of distributing in the volumes necessary for a presidential election, especially because there are hundreds of ballot styles for all of the races going on. So I think that's one of the key lessons learned. And I think that the things that people should really be aware of for November is, first of all, you won't be getting any sort of substantial results on election day. And part of that is there were changes made in the special section that specifically prevent counting all of the absentee ballots on election day, ballots that are returned into the drop box or received by the town clerk on election day must be counted the day after for good reason. And that is because given the volume of voters and the volume of ballots, this allows for a period of time to check that there was no double voting going on. But because the legislature has given 3 days in which to complete that process, and you have a weekend, you may not see results from some of the municipalities coming in until the Monday after the election. So I do think voters should be aware of that.
So I'll open this question up to the group. Fred just touched on the 3-day delay we may have in getting election results this November. What other concerns, what other things should voters or candidates from both parties have in mind as they look to ensure the integrity of this November's election? What's at the top of your mind when you think about concerns that you have casting ballots, be they absentee or in person, for November 3rd?
So I would just start with a question that we're getting over and over again is, can I apply for an absentee ballot and then not use it? And so what happens is people are, again, because of this tremendous fear associated with, on the one hand, fear with returning their ballots and, you know, using the post office. And on the other hand, with concerns that somehow absentee ballots aren't going to count because, you know, of declarations made by one or the other parties. That they want to have it in case COVID prevents them from going. But at the same time, if really necessary, they're willing to go to the polls. So it makes the planning of the election a little bit more difficult as far as staffing. And it also makes sort of a little more difficult in terms of, well, what kind of resources in terms of ballots, et cetera. In my town, so we ordered 130 ballots for 130% turnout. And one would think that would be enough ballots. But again, if thousands of people decide to get 2 ballots because it don't return their absentee, you actually could have a situation where ballots are going to be photocopied and they're going to be hand counted. And that's going to create all sorts of issues where now suddenly you're going to have people who are sitting there watching and observing that process. So, you know, that's a question that we're getting dozens of time every day in my office.
So I would say from a sort of, I'm not a candidate this year, but what I'm hearing from my folks, one, we have to redo a lot of the process. If we're going to go on this, continue on with absentee voting hereafter, there's the whole campaign process. You know, the way you get your money from the state is usually for most folks towards the end of summer, you have to start campaigning 30 days earlier. The absentee ballots went out October 2nd. So your signs had to be up the beginning of September, when generally you don't have it up maybe till the mid to the end of September. Your mail has to go out earlier. Your messaging, everything has to get moved up, which means that the campaign money that we get from the state, all that process has to be 1, faster and 2, earlier. Otherwise, there's a significant disadvantage. Some folks are still putting out their mail pieces now, and there's already, 500,000 absentee ballots in play of folks, and some who haven't gotten their campaigns off the ground. So I think there has to be, from a candidate point of view and from a legislature point of view, a review of that entire process if we go beyond here. I think the other thing that comes into play is we have the 1% rule. Maybe Poile and Fred could do the math better than me, but the 1% rule to determine when there's a recount. So if you get within a certain percent, 0.5%, I think it is, you end up with a recount. And when we recount, There's not a lot of absentee ballots, generally speaking. We just make sure that the little circle square is colored in. We put that back through and it counts. Well, if we're going to have a lot more absentee ballots, I think there should be more of a thorough review of those absentee ballots. And I'm not saying people commit fraud, but there's some people who don't understand that you fill it out, but you also believe you have a right to vote where you go to school, we'll say. So there should be more of an in-depth review of these absentee ballots. That's not done at this level, but when you're going to have close elections and you have a greater number of absentees ballots casted, I think it becomes more problematic. And as a final note, I think we should have an auditing process done on this election to find out the good and the bad, to find out how registered voters like Fred, and town clerks, what they felt was good about the system to make it more refined. Absent that feedback from boots on the ground, I think that's going to be a major problem in the future. And I'll just say this one last point. When the Secretary of State decided to mail out these ballots, she had the mail house, to Fred's point of view, doing the whole thing from soup to nuts. And that didn't work out well. And yes, we did ask her, why did these ballots go out late? And we never got an answer from the Secretary of State's office, with not a surprise. And now what she did was she sent out the ballots and told the register of voters, you guys deal with the hassle. You deal with the onslaught of applications. But no one went to the register of voters and town clerks and sat them down and said, tell us exactly how we could make this work for you so every vote does count and we could get a timely return on our vote count as quickly as possible. I don't think that conversation took place. And that's government sometimes thinking they could do everybody's job better than they can do. So those would be my comments.
You know, and I'll pick up, Josh, on the comment about, you know, what is it, what's the issue with respect to this heightened number, the volume that we're looking at with absentee voting? You know, one of the criticisms that would always come up when we were talking about trying to enforce the Constitution and continue to leave absentee voting to be restricted was, oh, you're trying to suppress votes. But that's not accurate at all. It's a false narrative. You know, the argument, really what's happening with absentee voting, and the reason the town clerks objected to the constitutional amendment in 2012 and 2019 is because of the fail rate. You know, the town clerks testified that in a normal election with a 5% participation rate amongst absentee voters, you had a 5 to 8% fail rate. So that meant that's 5 to 8% of people who are voting and don't even know that their votes weren't counted. I walk into a voting booth, I put my ballot into the machine, into the tabulator, I know my vote's counted. These individuals that are having their votes rejected after mailing them in aren't even made aware that they went to the effort to vote and they didn't end up participating. There's three states that do all mail-in voting. They're Oregon, Colorado, and Washington. It took them years to develop that. You know, the Washington Secretary of State took 7 years of planning to be able to do it. You know, Colorado's got 5 to 7 checks on signature match and processing. You can't just flip a switch on something like this because you do risk voter disenfranchisement. And that's one of the concerns, I think, why the Constitution was put in place so that there would be a thoughtful process and we wouldn't just flip a switch when it was, you know, kind of convenient to do so because it's such a significant process that really has to be respected or we just can't trust the election results.
And if I could just take one more step at this thing. So Fred talked about the cure. In the bill that originally that we were doing a couple of weeks ago for a session, there was a provision that was written in there that allowed the register of voters to call a absentee voter who failed in some degree, as Fred pointed out, some of those failures, to call them up and give them an opportunity to cure. But to do that on the fly is very difficult. The question was, well, what if they just called more Democrats than Republicans? And, you know, which ones are correctable, which ones not? So it was recognized, particularly the signing of the affidavit on the inner envelope, was a major issue that everyone was sort of concerned about. But there was no way to assure an effective way that someone who is running for office wouldn't feel as if there was a thumb on the scale. So we did talk about that. We got rid of it, but that was brought up.
And I think there's some very key points that have been made about a mature vote by mail process. And so there's actually a national advocacy organization, the National Vote at Home Association, run by the former Denver elections director. And Colorado has recently moved to a vote by mail. And so they grade a state's readiness for moving to a vote at home process. And in May, when they issued their most recent scorecard, Connecticut got 1 star out of 5. Now, we might have moved up to a 2 star out of 5, but some of the voter-centric aspects, such as a cure process, are not in place. And some of the security aspects, such as signature verification, are not in place. So I have a directive from the Secretary of State's office. I said, well, what happens when we're opening the ballot if the inner envelope and the outer envelope, the names are not the same? And they say, well, you're really not supposed to be looking at that. You're supposed to be looking if there's a signature. So I keep on going back and saying, well, if I happen to see that the outer envelope says James Dean and the inner envelope signature says Marilyn Monroe, shouldn't I be doing something about that? And I still haven't gotten a clear answer on that one. And these are the kind of things that are, you know, creeping up in the volume that Proloy mentioned of these that, you know, can have an effect on the election.
So both Fred and Senator Fasano touched on a concern that I have just based on what I've seen here in Stamford, Connecticut, which is the volume of absentee ballots that needs to be processed this election are so much more than the town clerks are equipped to handle based on the staffing that they're traditionally provided, and that there really hasn't been enough emergency funding to fill that gap, that at least here in Stamford, we have, I think it's 5 dozen volunteers facilitating the distribution and sort of tabulation of absentee ballots, including yours truly, who went in on a Monday morning for a couple of hours and reviewed envelopes and made sure that absentee ballot requests were properly submitted, and if not, stuck them in an envelope to be rejected and sent back to the voter. So it raises a concern, which is, you know, what can be done to, I guess, reduce the discretion or reduce the ability of a partisan actor in administering the election to tell their friends how to properly vote and maybe not tell their enemies how to not do it. You know, how do we ensure that the thumbs are not on the scale, as I think Senator Fasano put it, as these elections are administered?
Well, I will say that I think one of the, although absentee ballots are the province of the town clerks, you know, it is really a three-person system in the sense that you have the two registrars involved also. And I believe one of the greatest strengths in the Connecticut election system is the bipartisan nature of the registrar's office. So you always have these two sets of eyes with people who come from different interests, et cetera, looking at things. So, you know, we work very well together in my office and have created a whole series of educational materials to get out across the board to voters, whether it be through our town social media or we're doing some mailings, et cetera. But, you know, admittedly, you have situations where you're not going to have that agreement or you're not going to have that kind of funding in a town in order to properly educate folks. So it is a concern, and I don't know that I have a statewide answer for it.
So, you know, I think, Fred, but you did hit on it a little bit, which is the states that are using absentee ballots have signature verification. And, you know, we're trying to put a George Jetson type of voting system in a Fred Flintstone system that we currently have. And that's a problem. You know, I'm just reading that right now, New Haven got $93,000 for extra people to vote. I mean, look, the presidential is not going to sit in bated breath to see what the vote results are out of New Haven. And I don't think there's any great drama with respect to state rep or state senator, who's going to win that out of New Haven. There's no drum roll effect for that. We're pretty certain who those folks are. So logically, why are we putting so much money into New Haven that if they take a extra couple of days, the conclusion is, well, I could write the press today about the state legislature for New Haven. So, you know, it just goes to what are we doing? And if we're going to advance to a system that I'm okay with safeguards, we got to look at the entire system and where it makes sense, where the investment should be. We have to give the people who are entitled to vote the right to vote, but we also have to protect the valid vote. For every invalid vote, you've wiped out a valid vote. And people take the other side of the coin, but you need to look at the coin and say, we also have a constitutional obligation to protect the legal vote from being wiped out by an invalid vote. And that's the security part that we have to make sure we get right in our system. And if you look the way we do the absentee ballots, and you, Fred, you probably know about it more than I do, but there's not a lot of checking on any of this that goes on. And I think that's what we really have to get clear. Look, my daughter hasn't lived in Connecticut in 6 years. She's got the only two grandkids, lives in Florida. She's registered to vote in Florida. And I've got an absentee ballot on my desk for her to vote. So, you know, she hasn't voted in 6 years. And North Haven's pretty good in terms of cleaning out their system. But if I was not a good actor, no one would know what I did on that. You're never going to catch it. But that's the type of stuff we have to get better on if we want people to have the confidence in our election, which is so important, and the confidence that their vote is going to get counted when they do vote.
And Josh, I want to mention two other constitutional provisions that kind of make Connecticut unique nationally. We talked about the absentee voting restrictions being in the state constitution, but here's two other provisions. Our state constitution guarantees the right to a secret ballot. The way we protect that right with in-person voting is to give somebody a poll to be able to go ahead and fill out their ballot in privacy. When we're doing these absentee voting, it's done by the mail. Someone's filling out their ballot in their living room. They don't necessarily have that right to a secret ballot. They're filling it out in front of their spouse, in front of their friends, in front of a campaign worker. We have no way to protect that constitutional right. And you know, that's something that we lose with the lack of in-person voting. The other thing that's really interesting is the day, the count of the vote. So one of the things you hear, one of the reasons we can't start counting votes early in Connecticut is because our state constitution requires all votes to be counted on election day. And this question was posed to the attorney general back in 1957. And the attorney general issued an opinion letter. And the opinion letter said, you cannot count absentee ballots on any day other than election day. The question is whether you could start early. Now, there's an interesting argument about whether that means you can count after election day. It's usually not an issue because we're only talking about 2-3 in the morning the following day. The volume of absentee ballots isn't really going to, you know, be significant enough to make an issue of it. That obviously is going to be very different this year. And you know, there is an open constitutional question about that.
So I'd ask each of you to put sort of your policymaker hats on and be interested to hear, what do you think legislatively and constitutionally needs to be changed or could be changed or should be changed to allow for the best system of absentee ballot voting, if you think such a system should exist? You know, who should it go to, the time frames in which folks have to cast their votes, and what lessons were you think you're looking to learn or you're waiting to learn based on this November's election that might influence your answer to this question?
So I guess you have to start with an autopsy of this primary and this general election. That's got to be the starting point. And that would include the key players, which are town clerks and registered voters. They have to be involved because they do this on election days, and you have to get their input. And then you have to say you're going to commit an investment to the system. Now, we are going to, well, not me, but the legislature is going to vote again to put for a majority vote for early voting. I can't remember the details of the bill, and that's going to come up next session. And if it passes by majority in the House and the Senate, as Broloy has talked about, this will end up being on the ballot for those folks for a second time. The first time it failed, as he pointed out, for the Connecticut residents to vote whether they want that to happen or not. And if they do, we have to be prepared with the right answers, the right methodology, the right system in place, as, in my view, directed by registered voters and town clerks to make this happen. Otherwise, we're going to have a system that's going to lack the confidence, and that's going to be a huge problem with the public and those who are elected not feeling that that was a right election.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say, you know, until it's the will of the elector. I mean, whatever the voters say, I think that's number one. What has to be followed if they reject it again, you know, there shouldn't be attempts to try and skate around the Constitution. But from a policy standpoint, I think we did see a window on how troubling a volume of absentee votes can be on the reliability of the election. And it came out of the second congressional primary. You know, after the vote on the second congressional primary this past primary, you know, one candidate won by 26 votes. So they had a recount. The second candidate then won on the recount by 86 votes. That's a swing of over 100 votes. How reliable is that? And that's kind of the problem you have. It's just who happens to win after the last count. That's not how an election should be decided. Until we have the infrastructure in place to ensure that we have an accurate count with respect to absentee voting and in-person voting, we can't have this because it becomes a coin toss.
So I would follow up with some of the same points. And again, you know, a lot of my position is very nuts and bolts related to it. But the Oregon Secretary of State, who put in really one of the first vote-at-home systems, said every time a state has gone to one of those systems, it's only done after a number of elections. And really what you need to do is you need to develop the confidence that people we're talking about here. Number one, in terms of first get people used to absentee voting, okay? Let people request it. And then once you have a majority of people who are requesting absentees, if you get to that, okay, then maybe you consider a vote at home system. But during that time, you have these infrastructure pieces. For instance, there is very little technology necessary for us to add in a link to what's called intelligent barcoding with the U.S. Postal Service. So people can actually know when their ballot, not just when it was mailed, but where it is in the chain, okay, and what day they can expect it in their mailbox. That's what some of these other states are using. We looked at trying to do it independently in Greenwich, but you know, the Secretary of State controls that computer system, and we just couldn't make it, you know, work without them doing the adjustments. But there's a whole series of both infrastructure pieces and education pieces. You know, I've done some outreach into the African American community, and when I spoke to folks in that community, they don't like absentee ballots. They have a tremendous suspicion of that, and they're very happy to see the drop boxes. But for the most part, they like early in-person voting. You talk to people in the disabled community, mail-in ballots are terrible for them. We have no Braille ballots, and there is an attempt right now to stave off a lawsuit by the Secretary of State literally issuing one at a time from their office special electronic ballots to those who request them. There's a lot of different stakeholders in this that really have to be consulted before we move forward in this kind of a process on a wide scale.
And it's just an example of, you know, how seriously Fred has taken his obligation to sort of inform voters about the issues that could happen and how to make sure they cast their ballot appropriately. I think he's the only politician I've ever seen who is running for an uncontested election who has raised money and then spent it on Facebook ads and elsewhere to get information out to support the vote. But not every town and city in the state of Connecticut or across the country has a Fred DeCaro doing that. And the concerns about disenfranchisement, whether intentional or otherwise, I think are real and noted and need to be addressed moving forward. So I'll pause here to let the audience know that we welcome your questions if you want to punch them in the Q&A box down below. While waiting to see if anything comes through there, I'll ask a short one to this group. Are you going to vote in person or absentee? And relatedly, if someone comes to you and says, you know, hey, Senator, hey, Proloy, hey, Fred, I want to vote and make sure my vote's counted this election. How should I do that? What do you tell them?
I can tell you, Josh, I my wife and I will vote in person because for us, it's a real special day. We take our kids with us. We have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old into the voting booth and with our ballots. And, you know, it's a really neat moment for me, and I wouldn't pass on that. So that we will be voting in person with our family.
Well, I'm also going to be voting in person. Part of that is that myself and my counterpart have agreed that I'm handling the 13 polling places and she's handling the absentee ballots. So, you know, I have the opportunity to visit some of our polling places. But although I've always been eligible as an election official to vote by absentee, I've always made the time to go to my polling place.
I will be voting at the polling booth, and I gave my mom the option of voting absentee because she's 87. Probably shouldn't say that, but she's not watching. And she opted for me to pick her up and take her to the polling station. She does not want to do it by absentee because she believes the same thing Proloy does, which is, I want to go. It's election day. It's important for me to show that I care. So.
And, you know, we also find that with poll workers. So we do have quite a few new poll workers this year, and it's wonderful that a younger generation has stepped up. But I have poll workers who are septuagenarians and octogenarians and even a few nonagenarians. And many of them, they still want to be there. They want to be there. It's important for them. They're willing to, you know, put on the PPE and all that. But they have a real sense of duty in doing that. It's really is that greatest generation mentality.
And thanks are certainly owed to the volunteers and the folks that'll have PPE on for 14 or 16 or 18 hours this November 3rd as they administer the elections. I think I'll pause here to ask the panelists if they have any parting thoughts or parting ideas for this group's consideration.
Well, not to interrupt, but I do see a question did come in. I didn't know if you...
Oh, I didn't recognize it. Great. Thank you, Brian. It's a question to you. Can you give some color about your recent case? The one on behalf of the candidates in the 1st and 2nd Congressional District.
Sure, I can talk a little bit about the Fay versus Merrill litigation. This was, there's an organization that was our client called Fight Voter Fraud, run by Dominic Rapini and Linda Simplitz. And they had kind of studied a lot of these issues with absentee voting. And we had concerns when the governor issued his executive order. We had even more concerns when we saw the application that went out from the secretary that flat out said that all persons in bold print can vote by absentee voting. So the way the absentee applications went out, usually they have the statutory criteria. You say, I will be unable to vote at the polls for my physical, my disability, sickness, I'll be out of town, that type of thing, and religious tenets. She added a full category in bold type that said, COVID-19, all voters can vote this way. We had concerns about that because only the legislature is supposed to be able to expand absentee voting. That's in our constitution. And it should be tied to the individual's personal health circumstances. And that's certainly what the Texas Supreme Court determined based on similar language that they have. So we brought a declaratory judgment action in state court. A trial judge had rejected the argument and said the existence of COVID-19 is enough to qualify as a sickness, and it does not have to be tied to the individual. We had an expedited argument before the Connecticut Supreme Court, and at the time it was just the governor's order we were challenging, which had obviously a separation of powers element to it as well. In the middle, I think probably about 3 days before the oral argument, after the briefing was done, the legislature actually passed a statute ratifying what the governor had did to try and moot out the lawsuit. So we had a lot of discussion about that at oral argument, and we still pressed with, number one, it's beyond the governor's authority, but number two, it's beyond the legislature's authority, because until, based on what the electorate did in 2014, they haven't empowered you, no matter how well-meaning this may be, to act here. The court said they were affirming the decision, but would be issuing a written decision to with the rationale. And we're still awaiting that. So it would be ironic to get it a week before Election Day or the like to see kind of what the analysis is. But stay tuned, more to come.
Brian sends along his thanks. So thank you, Brian. Seeing nothing more in Q&A, is there anything any of the panelists would like to leave as a parting thought?
I guess this COVID is going to change a lot of things on a lot of different levels. And I think this voting is, the door is now wide open in the legislature to push for early voting. I'm not sure computer voting, but certainly early voting and a push for every election absentee votes applications to be sent out to every registered voter. I think that's the onslaught of bills we will see at GAE this coming session starting January 3rd or 4th.
I think I would add that there are usually competing tensions between security and sort of openness to the process. And unfortunately, I feel like in many cases here, we are only looking at one side of that. And some of the security doesn't make its way into, you know, the agreements and the laws. So I would certainly hope that there are some more balanced solutions that are put forth. I also think the other thing that comes from this is, and the senator touched on this, it lengthens the cycle, okay, for the political cycle. And we may all get a little bit more fatigue related to that when suddenly, the signs are out longer and the ads are out longer, and suddenly everybody needs more CEP money to sustain themselves for this longer period of time. People may just, quite frankly, just get tired also of this being the process. And, you know, as we see right now, 70% of the people who voted by absentee in my town said, I really want to go back to the polls.
With that, I'd like to conclude our panel. I'd like to thank very much our panelists. We appreciate you joining us here this evening. Thank you to our attendees for listening to this informative discussion on absentee balloting in the state of Connecticut. Hold on, I see a question come in here. Yep, thank you. Thanks from a different Brian. Hey, Brian, appreciate it. I hope everyone has a good evening and we look forward to being back in person as soon as possible. So until then, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks.